This is the 2006 Palm Springs Bible School. Brother Colin Badger's topic is The Ecclesia in the Wilderness, a thematic study of the book of Numbers. The topic for the second class is Preparations for a Journey of Service.
Dear brothers and sisters and our friends, and I suspect there are young people here this morning for sure, if not young at heart. You put yourself back into the desert environment that we were talking about yesterday with about 2.5 million people, and you wonder how they ever managed to convene together when they were being called to a general assembly. How it was a challenge, obviously, when we think of the challenges sometimes of just regrouping after having a break. 3 million people almost had to somehow coordinate themselves for general assemblies. Must have been challenging. I'm sure they had an hourglass, the type that has the sand in it. Well, we take a look, first of all, today at a little review from yesterday, where we were looking at the end of our class about numbers specifically, and granting the fact that numbers are dull and boring to a good number of us. Nevertheless, in the book of Numbers, better known to the Hebrews, as we said yesterday, as the book of the wilderness, numbers do tell a story. And just to recap from yesterday and use it as our bridge this morning, you remember that in Numbers chapter 1, when the census was made, we highlighted in particular the information on Simeon, which goes up to about there as their census was, slipping over to Judah up to about there. But relative to the rest of the tribes, we go back to Simeon, there in the tall yellow bar, and look at Simeon relative to the other tribes. So we actually highlighted those two because in the first census, the first numbering of Israel, in the first generation, those two are outstanding. But then, as the census is taken and now compared in the bar graph here, in Numbers chapter 26, at the end, we slip over to a dramatic change. In fact, in the case of Simeon, as you go down now and follow the red dot to that yellow bar, relative to what it was in Numbers 1. So you have what we call here a double bar graph. The red or the deep purple is what she was at the beginning in Numbers 1. And if you follow the red dot, there she was at the end of the wilderness journey. What a decimation. Judah, however, has remained fairly stable, if anything, spiked a little. There's got to be some explanation for that, and we will return to that later in the week and offer some suggestions, except to notice that these two sets of numbers tell a story in some way. And numbers are important in the book of Numbers as elsewhere in the Bible. And although we may not have a natural inclination to be too interested in numbers, this is God's book. And he did number Israel, and he did record it for eternity in his book called the Book of Numbers. Paying attention, therefore, to numbers in the Book of Numbers obviously is something we ought to do and see if we can tell what that story is. And, of course, we said yesterday, in sum, Simeon was decreased by some 37,100. It wasn't just the fact that they had a generation that died in the wilderness. All of this is relative to the same group of people that lost their parents, the first generation, and then grew up as the second generation in the wilderness. So let's pay attention to those key themes that run through the book. Now, yesterday we also touched on the fact that there were two censuses. I'd like now, just for a moment, to look at the big picture of the book of Numbers. We may not go away from the end of our five studies knowing a whole bunch about every chapter or every section. But the purpose, in part, this week is to get a big picture of a fairly large book, to get a handle on how the book of Numbers basically is put together. And when we're doing the readings, quite often, by the time we finish reading a book as large as Numbers, we've lost a grasp on how it all began and where we have journeyed through. So let's get a bird's eye view here of the book. First, let's get this picture, that there was a census at the beginning and there was one at the end. And that relates to part of the story in the wilderness of the book of Numbers. There is in the early chapter, as I just am clicking here successively, attention to the camp of Israel. So the book of Numbers sets the stage with a census, and then secondly focuses on the camp of Israel. This is a camp. They're going to embark on a journey of service, we say. Down here, there's attention in the book to the Levites, starting around chapter 4. Next, there's attention to the Nazirite vow, which occurs here in chapter 6. Then there's attention to the princes and the rulers of Israel. Then, down below, there is attention to the order of the march. Then, there's a section that goes across this double-arrowed indicator. There's a section across which it's possible to see a chunk, roughly in the middle of the book of Numbers, that concentrates on events that basically have certain things in common, and that is the theme of a lack of faith. Incident after incident in the hinge of the book are examples of Israel, the nation and individuals, lacking faith, and it comes out in their behavior. Have you ever seen that before? That in this long book of some 30-odd chapters, there's a kind of hinge towards the middle of the book that significantly focuses on examples of faith deteriorating and in some cases coming to almost the zero point. A little further, we come to the section that we're going to deal with in our fifth class, Balaam's prophecies. And we've called that a vision in the eye of faith. Now, when you think of Balaam's prophecies, I know they're rather enigmatic. There's some strange things said. There's a number of oracles. And sometimes the Balaam section is very puzzling. We know about the ass section. We know how he was riding on the ass. The angel stood and stopped. We know some of those highlights. We might remember that in that section of Balaam's prophecy, there's a reference to the Star of Israel. There's some references to the coming of Messiah. There are sections in Balaam's prophecy that deal with the history of Israel and her future. But in some, there's a point to Balaam's prophecies, because as you look at Balaam's prophecies as being visions of the future concerning the nature of Israel, her history, her stability, and the fact that she'd never be wiped out, the coming of Messiah and the coming of the king and the kingdom, what you really have in Balaam's prophecy there, in sum, is something that stands as a foil, a contrast to the hinge of the book. Not only that, but it's a contrast to the section back here where you have Numbers telling us the story of the spies and how the first generation got into the mess of losing their lives and not getting into the kingdom in that sense. At the end of the book, therefore, it's not without some purpose that you have several chapters dealing with a vision of the future. In fact, Balaam himself actually is perched on high points around the camp of Israel, down below on the plains of Moab. It is the eye of faith. The book of Numbers has a structure. It's not random. There's a purpose in the arrangement. The father, who arranged for an orderliness in the camp, surely could order the book that tells that story in a meaningful, maybe not chronological, but a meaningful order. God was concerned about order. He was concerned about it in the camp. He was concerned about it in the march. You can be sure in the book that records it all, there'll be some sense in the order. So that's a perspective if we haven't seen it before. At the end of the book of Numbers, there are various laws and feasts anticipating They're coming into the land. And they're given here because at this point of the book, he's really addressing the audience of Deuteronomy. We're edging towards the 40th year. We're talking now about getting into the land. We're addressing it to the second generation. See, that's appropriate as it begins to tie in with how you will behave in the land. And then you have a kind of chronology, like an appendix, a narrative of the journey at the end. It is obviously a summary. History is obviously more than Henry Ford said, bunk. It is meant to teach a lesson. Better what Churchill had to say when he said that really if you don't learn the lessons of history, you're destined to repeat the errors. A much better perspective than Henry Ford's perspective. That perspective, in fact, then is that at the end, there will be a series of diary entries highlighting where they came from, how they got into that difficulty, and now where they are at as they come to the edge of the wilderness and are ready to go into the land. See, there really is some sense to the scheme of the book. Now, since we're not always interested in census, we're going to tackle that just for a moment, but not in a detailed way. We're remembering, of course, the New Testament warned us against endless genealogies. Of course, you can go on the internet and find people so totally preoccupied today that aren't even Jews about their pedigree, their family tree, and the great history of their family. We're not concerned in that way, the way other people are concerned about this census. But here are some simple basic points, if you're looking at the book of Numbers, that might be useful. What was one purpose of the census? To determine and to call those qualified for battle. Numbers 3 and verse 4 is a case in point. It's the summary statement. Watch both of those points. It was to determine who was qualified for battle. That's not the same as calling those qualified for battle. A criteria was set. Who was qualified? The men of Israel of a certain age and up. Below, not qualified. The book of Numbers, as they embark on the wilderness journey, before anything negative happens, musters the nation and helps the nation to put on a set of glasses. They are going to go through this wilderness as an army. They're going to march through this wilderness as a victorious group, heading for the promised land. After all, behind them was the Red Sea and the end of the Egyptian adversaries. There was reason to therefore embark on this journey and think about themselves as a victorious group of people, a nation that was to become a kind of spiritual force, a spiritual army. So they're mustered, in the military sense of the word. First, who is able and qualified? Secondly, they're called. That's interesting. When you think of the spiritual application to ourselves as we put foot in the wilderness, as we begin a life of discipleship, the New Testament, the Lord Jesus Christ, calls us to become part of a spiritual force for good. We're called upon to be soldiers for Christ. We are described at times in the New Testament as a military group, spiritually speaking. Interesting, therefore, that the census, as dry as that might seem to some of us, had in fact a practical and spiritual purpose. What else? Well, according to Numbers chapter 2, there was another application or purpose for the census. It was also to order the tribes in their marching and their camping formations. To order the tribes, once they had the census, they knew who was who and who was where. They therefore were able to put them under respective standards, put them in their clans, their families, and order the camp, order the nation. The census wasn't only used for marching. It wasn't only used when they were being mustered for battle. The census number 2 was used to provide some order to where they place themselves, where they arranged themselves when they settled. Sometimes they may have only marched for a few days, would have to get back to settling themselves. It gave them their station in the nation, their place in the camp. So the census was related not only to their role as a military force, was also related to their ordering as they actually camped as well as marched. Would you turn now to Exodus chapter 30? This is no doubt involved in the purpose of the census in Numbers, but it actually is mentioned earlier in Exodus chapter 30. And I'd like you to turn there just for a moment. Exodus chapter 30, we want to look at verses 11 to 16. We're not going to read all these verses, but this is the section. I'm down here on the slide where I have the red dot. Exodus 30, verses 11 to 16, if that helps to follow. So now, another purpose of the census is related to what actually was mentioned also in Exodus chapter 30, where we read this. This sounds very much like the book of Numbers. Clearly, it would have been folded into the purpose of the census. Verse 12, please. Exodus 30. When thou takest the sum, or the numbering, of the children of Israel after their number, in the margin, Hebrew, them that are to be numbered. So when thou takest the sum of the children of Israel, margin, of them that are to be numbered, then shall they give every man a ransom for his soul unto Yahweh, when thou numberest them. Ah, there's the theme of the book of Numbers in part. That there be no plague among them when thou numberest them. Come down to verse 15 of Exodus 30. The rich shall not give more, the poor shall not give less than half a shekel, when they give an offering unto the Lord to make an atonement for your souls. In verse 16, it's called the atonement money. So the census of the book of Numbers undoubtedly would have also very much related to this earlier edict in Exodus. That is, one of the purposes of the numberings was to make sure, number three, that all of Israel were covered by the redemptive offerings that were based on the census, that every soul was numbered in order to make sure every soul was covered by the contribution of the atonement money, that they would contribute the shekel price. It was to make sure that they were all involved in the price, that they were all involved in the atonement itself. It was to ensure they all appreciated in contributing that shekel, that they were involved in that numbering directly related to their atonement. It is the atonement money. They weren't paying for it themselves. That's not the point. It was part of a numbering, a recognition, an inclusion of all. And so, brothers and sisters, that relates, doesn't it, to the New Testament in this way. We're described as having been bought with a price. We're described in the New Testament as having been bought by the precious blood of Christ. 1 Peter. There's a sense in which, therefore, at great price to the Father himself, that the Son gave his precious life, and his intention was that all would be included. Now that puts a dimension on the census. That puts a frame around the numbering that perhaps we wouldn't always bring forward as we come into the book of Numbers and sigh and think, oh, here we go, all of this census and all of this numbering. There was a practical reason, a spiritual purpose for the census. First of all, again, it helped them to see that their numbering, the census, was to help them see themselves as a military force for God. They were marching for God through the wilderness. They were part of a military band, a military troop. Secondly, it made sure there was orderliness in Israel as they camped, let alone as they marched. People who are marching that have no order are destined to disarray. Those who try to march through a wilderness and have no orderliness are going to get lost. Those who are disciplined and who are part of a coordinated force and who have some sense of order and orderliness are going to have a much greater chance to stand against the enemies that will set themselves against the ones who are going through the wilderness. And we know that at one particular part of the trek, there were those who picked off those who were behind. There were the Amalekites who hit them from behind and took the stragglers, took the weak, or those who were dispirited and disinterested, or who were dragging their feet. They were vulnerable. They had been numbered, they were part of the census, and by that they should have known their place, where they should have been in the ranks. You see, there was in fact a divine protection intended in this census, giving people a sense of where they belong, a sense of orderliness, where they were to be in the march, let alone in the camp, was to help ensure not just a fastidiousness and a preoccupation with order for its own sake. There was a spiritual divine reason. You know, Paul in Corinthians says to that ecclesia, let everything be done decently and in order. There's something to be said for a degree of casualness. There's also something to be said for a degree of orderliness. And there is a balance, but it's not order for the sake of itself. It actually does serve, as shown here, that there's a divine purpose. And most importantly, we might say, the number three issue, that God was counting his sparrows. Not one of them was intended to be lost. Jesus, you see, in that little analogy in the New Testament, was talking about numbering. You know how many sparrows are sold for such and such in the market, and not one of them is missed by the Father? You know how many hairs might be on a man's head or a woman's head. If you don't, the Father does. They're numbered. Numbering. You see, that little title the Septuagint gave does have some validity. Apart from numbers being viewed as the wilderness journey in Hebrew, the numbering should always remind us when we turn to the book of Numbers that the purpose of it all was that we would all be included. Young, old, even the mixed multitude would be included in the numbering. It is God's inclusiveness, his intention to count the sparrows. In fact, he doesn't need someone who's human to count the sparrows. But in being counted among themselves, the sparrows realize that they are of value. They have counted themselves. God could have done that in a flash. By being counted among themselves, therefore, really was showing them that God held them in his hand as a group of people. Young and old, mixed multitude included, there was an inclusiveness. Not one of them as a sparrow was to be lost. Not one of them as a sheep was to be overlooked. When we read the book of Numbers, think of numbers that way. Let's just go on then. We're going to turn to the New Testament, because did you know, in the Acts of the Apostles, there's an echo to the book of Numbers. As the curtain rises after the Master has left this earth, in Acts chapter 1, there is an echo to this numbering theme. Would you turn, as we have it here, Acts chapter 1, verse 15 and 17. Have you noticed this echo to the book of Numbers? To the ecclesia in the wilderness. Verse 15 of Acts 1. And in those days, Peter stood up in the midst of the disciples and said, the number of names together were about 120. Do you picture that? Here are the disciples together. They're still under a certain amount of duress. There's been a lot of stress. They've been hidden behind doors. The resurrected Lord has now given them the assurance by being with them for those days that he was. But there's a lot of newness to this whole experience. And look at the word said. Notice that. In those days, Peter stood up in the midst of the disciples and said. Peter has the registry. And without being prompted and without any lead-in, Peter stands up in the midst of the disciples on this particular occasion and says, we are 120 strong. Peter, what's this all about? What are you doing, Peter? Who told you to do that? Why are you doing that, Peter? Who asked you for an attendance count? Peter was undoubtedly, you see, acting under inspiration. You can read that and miss it. The sheep are numbered. The sparrows are counted. And Peter is prompted to do something exactly that Israel was commanded to do in the beginning of their wilderness journey. The resurrected Lord has left. The sheep are now in the wilderness of the Gentiles in the Roman world. And one of the first things, even before the day of Pentecost, Peter does is stand up and gives the census. We are 120 strong. That's a numbering. Isn't that amazing? But not only that, he gives the number, hold this, he gives the number of the names. Now, there's a difference. He doesn't just simply stand up and say there's 120 some of us strong. He's got the names. It's the number of the disciples? No, it's the number of the names. Now, that's personal. That's inclusiveness. And what do we find in the book of Numbers? As the curtain rises and there's a muster of the forces, we have the names of the heads of Israel. We have a name given to those who are the leaders. We have a kind of genealogy. It's the purpose of those genealogies. Purpose of the genealogies is not to tell God how many they are, nor to give God a family tree. But in counting themselves, they were to actually be involved in a sense of inclusiveness. It was an object lesson that they were being taken note of by a divine father, and they were the children. The family were being counted. The shepherd was counting his sheep in that sense. And the sparrows of the marketplace were being identified, not just by, well, we have 123 here. No, they were numbered by name. Tom Thorpe, he's included. David Lawrence is included. Ken Somerville's included. Bonnie Somerville's included. It wasn't just numbers. It was the number of their names. And that's what you get at the beginning of Numbers. And here, as the disciples are about to embark on their journey of service in the wilderness of sin in the Roman world, how powerful that the Apostle Peter counts the chickens by name. Would you come to 1 Timothy? This is an Alfred Nichols point. You may have heard this one before, but it's relevant here. 1 Timothy 5. I want you to come down to verse 8 and 9, please. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8 and 9. Dealing with widows in the first century, practical applications of discipleship. Verse 8 of 1 Timothy 5. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. Verse 9, let not a widow be taken, here it is, let not a widow be taken into the number under 80 years old, having been the wife of one man. Now in his notes on Timothy and Titus, Alf Nichols brought out the fact years ago in his series, which became a book, that in the Greek, that's a very specific Greek word. It means to be on the roll. It was used militarily by the Greeks and Romans for those especially who were registered as soldiers. Your margin does a half job on this. It says, beside taken, chosen. That's part of the idea. But as Alf Nichols says and shows, it has to do with those who are on a muster list or those who are on a military roll. And if you look up Vines or Strong's, you'll get this sense. It's those on the roll, those who are registered, those who are numbered in the ecclesial list in that sense. In other words, there's a qualifier here. There's a criteria for widows that are to receive ecclesial support. Family comes first. What can the family do? Secondly, what can the ecclesia do? And the criteria is tied to keeping a proper orderly roll or register of the widows, who, by the way, could easily be neglected and often are. Often are. God is ensuring, and Paul is doing it for him, that those who are especially vulnerable, those especially in need, like the fatherless, the widows are on a roll. Do you know at the beginning in the Acts there was a problem with that, where the Grecian widows were being neglected, and they had to have a little conference about that. There had to be a discussion, and there was a neglect issue. It's not going to happen again. It's going to be ecclesially something that's done decently and in order. Those who match that criteria, those who need to be on the pastoral concern list, are registered, and their names are there. And the ABs won't forget it, will they? Let alone the rest in the ecclesia. Isn't that interesting? It's in the spirit of Numbers. Would you turn now to Philippians? Little things in our readings that we read perhaps just in the context of the book itself without thinking of how it might have a bearing on a bigger picture like the book of Numbers and its theme. Now we come to this interesting phrase. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 3. Philippians 4 verse 3. And I entreat thee also, says Paul, true yoke fellow, help those women which labored with me in the gospel, with Clement also, and with other my fellow laborers whose names are in the book of life. The names in the book. It's a numbering, and it's a register, and it's not because God's memory slips. It is put that way, practically and concretely, by Paul to his human readers and followers and fellow disciples to help get them into a sense of appreciation for the concept of the book of Numbers. That there is a census, even today, in a sense. There is a numbering. There is a book of life kept by the Father, and names are in that book of life. May they not be erased. Isn't that a comfort? It goes back, in fact, to the lesson of the sparrows and the sheep. Not one is neglected. Now would you come to Revelation chapter 7, and all comes together here beautifully and comprehensively. We're back to the book of Numbers in a much more obvious way, though spiritually speaking. For in Revelation chapter 7, look at verses 3 to 4. Isn't this the book of Numbers, in a sense? Verse 3, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants. It's a journey of service. Sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads, says John in verse 4. And I heard the number of them which were sealed. And there were sealed 144,000 of the tribes of the children of Israel, of the tribe of Judah, of the tribe of Reuben, of the tribe of Gad, of the tribe of Asher. It's Numbers 1, 2, in a sense. You see, here we are in the last book. And here is a numbering, and here is a record, and here is a spiritual census. God didn't need humans to keep a record. It's to help them appreciate where they stand and that God cares, God preserves, God knows who we are. Well, brothers and sisters, that puts a perspective, I think, on the book of Numbers as a journey of service that perhaps helps us to appreciate as we travel across this book that those two little purple sections that we've highlighted have a spiritual significance in the first and second generation. And later on, in the New Testament, as the New Testament disciples, the second generation, the spiritual generation that's to come into the kingdom, God willing, are numbered, and their names are there in Acts 1, and we come back to it in Revelation. Now, across the book of Numbers, looking again at the structure of the book, I'm going to just highlight a few other points that could be missed in terms of the meaning of the structure. At the beginning here where I'm pointing, there's the camp arrangements in Numbers 1 and 2. Then we have reference to the Levites, chapters 3 to 4. We're back to the camp again in chapter 5, dealing with the laws concerning cleanness of the camp. Now, the Levite, the leper, and the dead body. We have the law of jealousy in the same chapter, which we're going to return to later this week. We have the law of the Nazarites in chapter 6. Reference to the princes and the rulers in 7. Back to the Levites in 8. The Passover, chapter 9. And the march in chapter 10. Now we're taking a chunk out of Numbers, but it's a significant chunk. How so? Have you noticed this? In blue, just to make it a little easier, the Levites are here and the Levites are there. In the first 10 chapters, therefore, there's a lot of attention given to the role and the purpose of a priesthood. They were all called to a priesthood, in a sense. They were called to be a kingdom of priests, as we are. No doubt, then, in the first 10 chapters, in the stage being set in the book of Numbers, there's reason to concentrate Levitically. Concentrate on the theme of priesthood. The priests were to be, in a sense, the spiritual supervisors, the spiritual advisors, the spiritual judges, but they were also the role models. They were all to be spiritual priests, in that sense, both men and women. Women? Oh, yes. Because significantly, uniquely in the book of Numbers, before the ever march, in chapter 6, between these two sections of referring to the laws of the Levites, almost smack there in the middle, is the law of the Nazarite, which beckoned, invited man or woman to take a Nazarite vow for a temporary period of time, voluntary. But if you look carefully at the law of the Nazarite, it simulates the role of a priest. Many aspects of what's given there in Numbers chapter 6 about the law of the Nazarite simulates the role of the priest. In fact, some of the terms used to describe the crown and the hair covering of the Nazarite is exactly the word used to describe the crown of the high priest. So it's not without significance that here the Nazarite vow is couched between the two Levite sections. It's a counterbalance. They were not to understand that only men were related to the priesthood. In the real, ultimate sense, they'd all been called, even before Sinai, to be a kingdom of priests, as we are brothers and sisters today. Roles will be different, but there's a sense in which we're all to become part of a royal priesthood. Nor is it without significance that the camp would be described first, generally, but then the cleanness of the camp in chapter 5, the holiness of the camp as a reflection of God. So he returns to the camp, but now he talks about it specifically in terms of how the camp is to exhibit the holiness of God. Nor is it without significance, as you come here, in the 9th chapter, that just before the march, in fact, they are called to celebrate the Passover. And you know, before they left Egypt, before they came out as a military force from Egypt, they celebrated a Passover. Before they were mustered and they were brought to the edge of the Red Sea and directed by their commander to go across the Red Sea, before that, they celebrated the Passover. It focused on redemption. It focused on the atoning principles that were to save them. It focused on the cost of their redemption. It's not without significance that in the structure of the book of Numbers and the way the journey of service is chronicled in the book of Numbers, that just before they're mustered properly to go forth as a marching band, before they embark on this journey militarily, they're in fact connected to the Passover. There it is, significant as a reflection of the past. And we said before that times have some significance. Just by way of perspective, as now we step a little closer into the specifics of Numbers, and just by way of perspective here, from Numbers chapter 1 and 1 to Numbers 10, the beginning of the march that we just talked about was only 20 days. Interesting perspective. Another 38 years was to pass. However, 38 years was to pass beyond those 20 days before they finally came to Numbers 33:38, which was the 40th year. And here, in Numbers 33 and 38, it was the fifth month of the 40th year. 38 years had passed. 2 years had brought them up to this point. And as we said yesterday, they could have made the entrance to the land within a matter of perhaps no more than 2 weeks. But by way of time, it's interesting to see that the first 10 chapters of the book takes up only 20 days. The rest of the book, some 38 years passed until we come to Numbers 20, verse 1, which is the first month of the 40th year. And by the time you're 13 chapters beyond, at the end of the book of Numbers, you're in the fifth month of the 40th year. So Numbers is selective. Numbers focuses on the beginning and on the end, and not too much in between. It is a selective history, and therefore it's a spiritual one. It's interesting to put Numbers against the book of Exodus now, since we've talked about the Exodus. By way of perspective, as they embark on this spiritual journey of service, whereas Exodus as a book focused especially on the story of Israel's redemption from bondage, I think it could be fairly said, however, that Numbers has the accent on service in the wilderness. Redemption and its principles from bondage, coming out as formerly slaves, atoning redemptive purposes and principles. But then let's get on with it. Having now been atoned, related to the baptism in the Red Sea, baptism into Moses, related to the Passover, having now celebrated the Passover again in the second year, they embark on a journey of service. And that's the main focus as we now travel beyond chapter 10 in the book of Numbers. Service that God calls them to, and service, in fact, that was failed. When we focus, brothers and sisters, at this junction on the theme of service as the purpose of the journey, service also when they finally would go into the land, that service was all to be focused around the hub, the center point that was always there in Israel's midst. When they contemplated this journey through the wilderness and thought about its meaning of service to God, they couldn't help but miss the point when they're mustered, in fact, like an army. That's got to do with service. Service in the military, in that sense. Service as a force. But in their midst, day by day, they could never miss the point that in the holiest of holies, there was a holy God in the middle of their camp. The camp as a whole, when they went to war, holy principles and hygiene were reinforced. Because even when they went to war as a separate contingent of soldiers, never were they to forget that they were connected to the God of Israel, who said, "I am holy, therefore be ye holy." So service was intricately linked to the theme of holiness. Holiness in God's dwelling. Numbers chapter 5 and verses 1 to 3 we've already referred to when we did the chart. Those three verses talk about what to do with the leper, what to do with the dead body, and what to do with the one that had the running issue, all in three verses. It's elaborated in Leviticus. Why do we have that before the march? It's talking about cleanness in the camp of Israel. And if God is in their midst, the implication is they must live clean lives. It's relating directly to Brother Anthony's theme this morning. The fruit of the Spirit versus the works and the thinking of the flesh. All of the vices that we looked at in Galatians there with Brother Anthony, they're relating to what was being shown by the dead body, the impure issues that defiled them. And finally, of course, the leper in their midst. Very practical. Numbers chapter 15, verses 40 to 41, you might want to write it down. It simply states a passage you know well, said otherwise in Leviticus. It is a passage simply stressing that their holiness was related to the fact that a holy God was focused in their midst. So his presence had implications for them. It was a privilege, but it had implications. So as the camp moves forward in Numbers chapter 10, the holiness principle and the orderliness principle, the inclusiveness principle of the numbering, all were brought to bear as the march began. And being called to a holy priesthood, all of them were to understand that they were all called to serve God and to serve one another. Practical principles for the ecclesia in the wilderness. So that census that we started with earlier has now a very direct and obvious bearing on number two here as they began the march and experienced camping and breaking of the camp and then coming back again. And the march itself, poised here after the Passover then, is further reinforced, as we've said, by that Passover experience that would have brought them back from their start 2 years ago when they left Egypt. Finally, brothers and sisters, the obvious reason in asking that question about the Passover is it leaves us with the impression that there are divine principles connected to this journey of service. Let's just conclude here this morning by noticing that in the reading we had, Psalm 68, there are some themes related to this march of service. Psalm 68 is very much focusing on the theme of Numbers and the ecclesia in the wilderness, just to select a few. Let God arise, verse 1, says Psalm 68. Let his enemies be scattered. They were going to have enemies, as we do. The forces of evil, the darts of the wicked, the carnal influences that Brother Anthony stressed in the first class will assault the camp of Israel. The vices of Galatians 5 will challenge Cosby and others in Numbers 25 when the Moabites are set up to seduce by their women carnally the weaknesses of human nature in the men of Israel. There will be challenges with the serpents in the wilderness. There will be murmurings. There will be leadership issues. There will be jealousy. There will be strife. There will be envy. All of those vices in Galatians 6 and 5, I should say, have their manifestation in the wilderness. Every one of them. Psalm 68 says that God is a father of the fatherless, a judge of the widows. Is God in his holy habitation? As they moved through the wilderness, they were called upon to serve one another, to be concerned about the fatherless, to be concerned about the widow, as they were in the New Testament as well, when they were numbered and called to the register. Verse 6 of Psalm 68 says, God setteth the solitary in families. He sets his people out in the wilderness as a family. He numbers his children. He numbers his flock. He bringeth out those which are bound with chains. Think of Israel coming out of Egypt. But the rebellious dwell in a dry land. Who's that? It's the generation that perished. And finally, O God, Psalm 68, verse 7, O God, when thou wentest forth like a shepherd, like John 10, like the good shepherd, O God, when thou wentest forth, watch this, before thy people, when thou didst march through the wilderness. Brothers and sisters, it wasn't just the people who marched. It wasn't just about 3 million pairs of legs moving through the desert sands. Marching in their midst as their commander and as part of this force for good, this spiritual band, marching with those feet was the God of Israel in their midst. And when the army rested, he rested. When he rested, they rested. When he marched, they marched. But like the shepherd, he marched before them. And as he brought them into the land eventually, he was to show them continually that their march was a march of service to each other and to their God.